surveillance operator, and even they work in teams. In order to catch him, I'll have to resort to something a little more straightforward and risky. It involves me pulling up next to his car for about a minute and praying that he doesn't come walking out and see me. It's also illegal, but I'm far beyond caring about that. Somewhere there's a young boy whose life depends on me. Turning the wheel into the parking lot feels like trying to push the rudder of a massive sailing vessel. Ignoring the looming Oyo storm would be so much easier. I drive down the small asphalt road and take the spot next to Oyo's Cadillac, which appears to be only a few years old and still has California plates. I suspect that he leases them or buys a new one every few years, not for the sake of vanity, but because it makes finding hair and fibers from previous crimes impossible. At the height of their suspicion, police literally sat across the street from Ted Bundy, waiting for a search warrant while he washed his Volkswagen Beetle, scrubbing away the forensic evidence they were desperately seeking. I take a breath and then pull out the map I'm using as a cover for my actions. It's a bit of an anachronism, but still plausible. I have already prepared a touristy question I can ask the first person who spots me, if necessary. With the map on the steering wheel, I take out my little device and make sure everything is working. Because I don't have access to the wafer-thin devices the DIA uses in its operations, I have to improvise with the hope that Oyo isn't paranoid enough to sweep his car for trackers. My gadget is a simple, off-the-shelf cell phone I bought at a Walmart, plugged into a USB battery brick, and packed into a small hobby box I got at Radio Shack. Glued to the box is the largest neodymium magnet I could find on short notice. I check to make sure nobody is coming, open my door, and lower my body to the ground. If I'm spotted in this awkward position, I've already got my own phone in my other hand, so I can stand up with that, pretending to have dropped it. As I squat and nervously try to stick my tracker on the undercarriage of his car, repeatedly popping my head up over the door like a nervous gopher, I'm keenly aware that I'm not cut out for field work. It takes me an eternity to find a spot for the magnet, and once I do, it makes such a loud metallic clang, I'm afraid folks will hear it all the way in the church. But nobody comes running out. I give the jury-rigged tracker box a firm tug. Good. At least it won't be coming off by itself. I pull myself back into my driver's seat, adrenaline still pumping. I give one more check to make sure I'm not being watched and start to back out of my parking spot. I pull away from the church and turn into a gas station across the street and down half a block. As I fill my rental car's tank, I keep an eye on Oyo's car, waiting to see if he comes running out to see what the mysterious man was doing to his vehicle. He doesn't. After topping up, I debate if I should wait to see what he does next, but decide that my skills aren't quite up to that task. I need to stick to data points and not this hands-on shit. As I've proven repeatedly, it's not my best talent. Next up for me is to check the third piece of property I found linked to the toy man and his church. It's raised a number of red flags in my mind, but it seems a little too brazen. I can't imagine that Oyo would do his crimes somewhere that it would be easy for the police to get a search warrant. But who knows? Maybe he's perfectly at home in his John Christian persona. Chapter 53. Retreat. In my research into John Christian / Oyo Diallo's ministry, I found out that they have a small parcel of property west of Atlanta near Sweetwater Creek State Park. Called Children's Christian Camp, it's 2 acres of land with 3 buildings, a small pool, a rather uneven soccer field, and a fire pit, according to Google Earth. The website says it's a Christian retreat for poor and underprivileged children. While this sounds like a child killer's delight, the camp itself isn't exactly what you'd find in a Friday the 13th movie. There are no fences, and the buildings lie largely in the open, with plenty of neighbors. Like Oyo's house in the suburbs, this isn't where a murderer would feel comfortable chasing buck naked after children. However, the camp itself seems like the ideal place to spot and groom potential victims. While Oyo is away, I decide to drive over to the currently empty camp, according to the schedule, at least, and look around. I park my car and walk around the buildings. They're all older wooden structures, painted white with dusty windows. Peering through them, I spot a cafeteria and an activity room where the shelves are filled with board games. The other buildings include four standalone bunkhouses with 10 bunks in each, as well as a freestanding shower and a bathroom structure like you see at campgrounds. In the pictures on the camp's website, the kids spend a lot of time in tents and doing activities in the field. There's no lake and none of the amenities of a regular summer camp, but for a kid from a poor family, it doesn't seem like the worst place in the world, other than the fact that it's run by a child killer. At the far end of the property is a state forest. To the west lies a compound with a high fence, to keep the children's noise out, I suspect. On the internet, the neighboring property was listed as McEntry Nursery, but there's no signage visible from the campsite of the property. What growth I can see over the fence looks a little overrun. I walk around the camp again, making sure I didn't miss anything like a fallout shelter or some kind of underground bunker. While I'm not sure that I would know it if I stood over one, I'm reasonably sure the toy man's lair isn't buried beneath his children's Christian camp. Although this could be a killing ground, and while the house at Wimbledon was also where he buried some of his victims, it seems fairly unlikely someone as intelligent as Oyo would be willing to risk a bunch of hyperactive kids playing a game of dodgeball over a trove of poorly concealed bodies. He has better hygiene than that. Most serial killers don't. There have been numerous instances when police have shown up on a serial killer's doorstep while victims were screaming for their lives just a few feet away in muffled crawl spaces or locked inside hidden rooms. They found 26 of John Wayne Gacy's victims buried under his home. What was left of Jeffrey Dahmer's was in his refrigerator and in almost every part of his home. I walk over to a ring of logs surrounding a fire pit. Using the toe of my shoe, I kick around the ashes, just in case there's something that shouldn't be there. Despite containing some melted plastic and foil, it doesn't appear to be a cremation pit. Everything about the camp is what you would expect, whereas simply glancing at the house on Wimbledon gave me anxiety. I return to my car to head back to my hotel so I can take a look at Oyo's location data and build a map of the places he's driven to in the last few hours. I hope at least one of them is his secret place. Finding that now could literally be a matter of life and death. As I reach for my rental car key fob, my phone rings, startling me. "Hello?" I reply as I take a seat.
"What the fuck, Theo? What the fuck?"
Birkett? It sounds like the angriest version of her I've ever heard.
"What did you do?"
"What do you mean?" I nervously glance around, expecting police sirens and helicopters. "Los Angeles? That thing?"
"That thing? Jesus! No, I'm talking about your weirdo hobby. I'm talking about how I'm trying to smooth things over with Park so he doesn't make your life difficult, and how I'm talking to a friend who handles contractor internal affairs for the DIA. I asked to see what Park may have said after your, disagreement with him, and she mentioned someone pulled your RA jacket."
"My what?"
"Risk assessment jacket. It's the file where they list all of your potential security liabilities. It's how we keep track of all you assholes and make sure you're not about to go all Snowden on us and spill your guts to the Russians. Someone was very interested in you."
"Park?" I reply.
"No! How can someone this smart be this stupid?"
"It's a daily struggle," I reply.
"It's from another agency."
"Which one?"
I can't tell you that shit! But let's imagine the DIA with one different letter in our acronym.
The CIA.
Why the hell are they asking about me? Why the hell...
Wait. She stops as she realizes she was about to repeat my question.
Why the hell are they?
If I told you I didn't have a clue, would you believe me? And should you even be asking me this?
If they'd filed a proper gag request, then no, but they didn't, so it's office gossip. But seriously, Theo, if I find out you've been burning classified docs onto Lady Gaga CDs, I'll have your balls.
That was Manning, not Snowden.
I fucking know the difference!
She takes a deep breath and manages to sound slightly less combustive. Slightly.
This isn't just you, it's me. I pulled so many strings to get you this job. I made a lot of promises. Your back and forth with Kavanaugh doesn't help, but at least he respects someone with the conviction to air his grievances. If you're up to some shit, my ass is done. And I like what I do. I will personally hunt you down, cut your dick off, or make sure that when you're in federal prison, some motherfuckers do that to you. Understand?
Yeah.
Understand?
Jesus, yes. Whatever my convictions, they don't involve me spending time in federal prison or the rest of my life in Russia, depending on a bunch of former KGB spooks looking after my well-being.
Good. I'm glad we're on the same page.
Yeah. Trust me. I wouldn't do anything like that to fuck you over.
Fine.
She takes another long breath.
I believe you. But I wonder if you could be a sociopath.
I ask myself the same question.
You're not helping me feel better. Just tell me, is there anything you could have done that raised a red flag somewhere?
Well, shit.
Theo?
I'm not going to tell her about my little germ experiment or what that uncovered, especially because it involves putting genetically modified microbes on the literal doorstep of the DHS. There are absolutely no good optics on that. Plus, she'd be duty-bound to tell her superiors, and right now, someone pulling strings doesn't like me. It could be Park using an intermediary to fuck with me, but I don't want to push it in case it's not. You saw my name in the news? I ask rhetorically. Maybe somebody in some other agency was just curious? In the coverage, I'm just listed as a consultant for OpenSky AI. Maybe someone at some other agency was curious about what I was doing there?
Mm-hmm,
she says, not buying my explanation.
What else you got?
I can't say.
You're so goddamn transparent. What?
I can't tell you anything other than this. The House of Horror in Los Angeles? The suspect that died in Brazil? He ain't the main guy.
So this is why you're in Atlanta?
How did you know that?
I work for an intelligence agency, dumbass. Also, I had to make sure you weren't off to the welcoming arms of the Chinese. Never defect there. Jesus Christ.
Got it. So, what I can tell... Well, the guy who I think did this... He might be an informant.
Okay, she says patiently.
For who? Possibly the Department of Homeland Security.
Muslim?
No, it's more complicated, and not a domestic informant.
Shit, Theo. You went sniffing around a protected informant?
I don't know that's the case, but this guy is bad, real bad.
That's why we use them as informants. The good guys don't know anything.
Yes, I reply. But this is the guy that murdered at least 17 kids in Los Angeles.
If you got proof, send it to me and we'll get it to the FBI.
I'm working on it.
What does that mean?
It means that I need to make sure they follow through right away. This guy may be about to kill a kid, and if I screw this up, he'll cover his ass and go do it again and again while I'm answering awkward questions. She sighs loudly.
You better know what the hell you're doing.
No shit.
And watch your back. Not everyone on our team is playing by the same rule book.
Chapter 54. Package. Burkitt's ominous warning is in the back of my mind as I walk down the hallway of my hotel to my room. I was already paranoid, but now I'm even worried about the people who are supposed to be on my side. I put my key in the door, flip the light on, and see a distinguished older man in a three-piece suit lying on top of my bed, reading a Clive Cussler novel. I back up and check the door number.
"You have the right room, Dr. Cray," the man says as he sets down the book. "Please have a seat. My back has been acting up, so I took advantage of the firm mattress."
I look for a gun or some kind of weapon. His hands are folded across his stomach in the least threatening way possible. He looks like a totally relaxed lawyer or businessman. I drop into a chair across from him, trying to get some read on who the hell he is and why he's here. I should call the police, but he's engaged my curiosity. Plus, my gun is within reach.
"Comfortable?" asks the man.
"Yes."
"Are you?" "Much better. It was a long drive."
"And what was the purpose of the drive?"
"To assist you, Dr. Cray. You're a man with lots of questions, and I'm here to provide what answers that I can."
"Well," I reply, not sure if this man is insane or just creepy. "Who are you?"
"You can call me Bill."
"Just Bill?"
He nods. "Just Bill."
"Well, Bill, I can already tell you're not going to be very helpful. It's been pleasant." I stand up and motion toward the door. He doesn't move.
"Dr. Cray, do you know the preferred treatment for trigeminal neuralgia?"
"No, I'm not that kind of doctor."
"Precisely. I'm not that kind of question replier. You need to ask relevant questions. Please have a seat. What you should be asking me is how I'm going to help you."
"With John Christian?"
"With not going to jail, Dr. Cray. May I call you Theo?" "That should be your most pressing question at this moment. How are you going to avoid spending the rest of your life in prison?"
I get it now. This guy is some holdover Cold War spook they pulled out of retirement to scare me.
"Funny," I reply. "That's not really a major issue for me right now. I'm wondering how you live with the idea that you're protecting a murderous piece of shit that's about to kill again."
"I have no idea who you are talking about," he replies.
"You have no idea about the 17 dead kids they pulled out of the backyard of a Los Angeles home that one of your assets used to live in?"
From Bill's stare, I can tell he really does have no idea what I'm talking about.
"Seriously?"
I groan.
"You're just some guy they call up when they want to scare the shit out of someone, but they don't tell you why?"
"They tell me. I've seen some security footage of a man acting very peculiar in the hallway in front of a Department of Homeland Security office, possibly spraying some kind of chemical agent, before foolishly stepping inside and presenting his identification."
I get up from my chair and walk to the door. "For a solid minute, you had me worried."
Bill doesn't move.
"I'm doing you a courtesy."
"Right. You're all heart. When DHS or the CDC comes knocking on my door, I'll start to panic. But when some CIA fossil sends some other fossil to scare me because they can't even imagine the size of their fuck-up, I'll just have to take a pass on a freak-out." I open the door. "Time to go back to your suburb in Alexandria or wherever and tell your pal he should take a closer look at who the hell he's getting his information from."
Bill gets to his feet. He has a slightly amused look on his face. He stops at the door. "You're not going to like what happens next."
He shoves his hand into his pocket. I grab his forearm. "You're not going to like where I put that, Bill." He slowly withdraws his hand and pulls out my little black box.
"It wasn't hard to find the first time. I'm sure it won't be the next."
He drops the box into my hands and then starts walking down the hallway.
He's almost at the elevator when I decide to run up to him.
Wait!
I call after him. Bill turns around. Yes?
What do you know about him?
I've been given a very simple task, Dr. Cray. I'm the messenger. Message delivered. He turns away. I grab him by the elbow.
Stop that spy novel shit. Forget all the message delivering. Let me talk to the idealist in there that signed up when Khrushchev was banging his shoe and threatening to bury us. The guy who knows right from wrong. Do you know who the fuck John Christian really is?
His face is a blank expression. I see a man who has been so beaten down by the system that he just doesn't care anymore. When the phone rings, he delivers a pizza. He doesn't care what's in it or whom it's really feeding. All he knows is that when the order comes, he'd better deliver the fucking pizza. I let go of his arm. He turns back to the elevator and presses the down button. In the polished metal of the elevator doors, his cold eyes watch me. The blank expression is gone for a moment. I walk back to my room, trying to figure out if I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night with Bill strangling me with piano wire, or if I'm going to get a harsh letter from Human Resources about my treatment of the elderly. I stare down at my tracker. The old fossil didn't even bother turning the phone off before giving it back to me. Did he even realize that it kept a complete log of everywhere Oyo went and where Bill was after? Sheesh. Chapter 55. Hunting Ground. When I went after Joe Vick, the only deadline in my head was getting back to school before the semester began, which I failed at. While he'd murdered someone I knew and his other victims left me unsettled, I still thought of Joe Vick in the past tense. Uncovering his crimes was like brushing away the dirt on an archaeological site and realizing that the Neolithic tribe practiced ritualistic murder. It could be shocking, but it was a thing of the past. You didn't worry about the skeletons leaping out of the ground and continuing their murderous ways. You didn't worry about the safety of some contemporary person. With Vic, even though I knew he was still an active killer, I had no time frame to motivate me. Taking 2 days or 2 weeks didn't seem like it would cost anything, except my own professional career. With Oyo, it's different. The sun is up, and by the time it sets, he'll probably have his next victim. By the time it rises again, a young boy will be dead. I'm tearing myself apart, because I could have done more over the last few days. If I'd run to the news, someone would have covered the story. I could have brought some temporary attention to Oyo and saved a life. Maybe. But then what? He'd slip away and show up somewhere else, wiser to the fact that I was able to find him. He could leave the United States and pop up in some other country where his murders would be even harder to find. Which makes me wonder, what was his friend Ordavo Sims doing in Brazil? Was he more than a lackey? Is Oyo part of something bigger than I understand? I don't even understand him, let alone what else he could be a part of. The man isn't merely a sociopath manufactured by a conflict. Like Joe Vick, he's someone with a particular talent for concealment and murder. He's a natural-born predator in a world of prey. His concealment is so strong that I've lost him already. The tracking data from my phone shows that he left the church and went to his house and then another house in a nice Atlanta suburb that belongs to a wealthy attorney. After that, he returned home and the tracking device came straight back here, courtesy of Cold War Bill. There's no mysterious trip to a suspicious warehouse on the outskirts of town. The attorney he visited in the suburb, Grayson Hunt, represents a variety of international corporate clients, and is exactly the kind of person someone like Oyo would want to cultivate. Beyond that, there's not much of a connection. I'm out of options. As a last resort, I've parked down the street from Oyo's house, and have been watching his Cadillac in his driveway. It hasn't moved. I don't even think he's home. he's slipped me. I wait until 9 o'clock a.m. and call the church. I'm that desperate.
Friends of Salvation Church, says a cheery woman.
Hello, I was wondering if Minister Christian was in.
I'm sorry, but he's at a religious conference in Denver, she replies.
Oh, when did he leave?
Last night, I believe. He should be back in a week. Is this a spiritual matter?
Of sorts, thank you. A religious conference. It's a good cover. Tell everyone you're leaving a day early, go do your killing, and then head straight there. If anyone asks questions, their memories will be so hazy, it would be hard to pin down where exactly you were at that point. It would be up to investigators to make the case otherwise. It also explains why his Cadillac is sitting in his driveway. Oyo can't be spotted around town in that when he's supposed to be elsewhere. Atlanta is a big city, but it still acts like a small one. Word travels. Oyo probably has another car and another identity, one tied to his hidden lair, the one I can't find. It's the thing right in front of you that's the most important. The family calling the cops over 100 times about John Wayne Gacy. The Laotian boy who ran from Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, screaming, only to be returned there by the cops because they thought it was a lover's quarrel. One of Lonnie Franklin's victims brought the cops almost to his doorstep, only to be off by one house. The warning signs for Ted Bundy were everywhere. Each time the police got close, he moved on to another jurisdiction. At the height of his murder spree, there were cops that knew exactly what he was, but they were limited in what they could do. Somebody knows something, and the one person who seems to know more than anyone else around here is Robert. There's a remote chance he may be an accomplice of Oyo, but there's also the possibility he's another bystander, simply trying to keep clear of the man. With no other viable plan, I call his cell phone. It goes straight to voicemail. I try again a few minutes later. Voicemail. These are desperate times, so I drive to Ms. Violet's home. Robert is on the porch, talking to an old white woman with a black poodle sitting in her lap. There's a BMW parked in front of Violet's house, which I assume is the old woman's. As soon as I pull up, he glances at me and his expression changes. He's been making the woman laugh, keeping her company, while she waits her turn to go inside and have her fortune fabricated. Robert strides across the lawn and meets me as I get out of my car.
Mr. Theo, you don't have an appointment for today.
I'm no longer Mr. Craig. Apparently he did have a look inside my wallet.
I'm not here to talk to Ms. Violet. I want to know about this man that you and the Moss Man stay clear of.
Robert glances over my shoulder at the woman sitting on the porch, making sure she's not paying attention to our contentious discussion. This tells me she's a valuable client.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Someone who practices a very bad kind of magic, the kind involving human sacrifice. Robert searches for a response.
I don't have anything to do with that.
But you know about someone who does. His face is a mask.
Oyo, or John Christian, as he's known around here.
Robert blinks at the mention of the name, then shakes his head.
I don't know who you're talking about.
He reaches for my door handle.
Please come again some other time.
I nod to the woman. Is she important? Maybe a widow or has some dead kid? What's she worth to you?
Mrs.
He stops before saying her name.
She's an old, dear friend of Ms. Violet. Now please, let's talk some other time.
Why don't I talk to her? What would she and her rich friends think about a story involving someone you know who murders little children? How will that go over? He grabs my arm.
Mr. Theo, don't do that.
Then tell me something, because this man you're protecting is about to kill another child.
He shakes his head. This man is very powerful. You don't know who you are dealing with.
Tell me something, Robert. Tell me something so that when you look your God in the eye, you can convince yourself you're a good man.
He's struggling with this. Let me put it to you this way. Soon, the whole world is going to know about Mr. Christian. What do you want your part of the story to be?
He scratches the back of his neck, wrestling with what to do.
All right. All I can say is that there's a place we know not to send our children.
The summer camp? I was there. There's nothing there.
That's all I can say, Robert replies.
Maybe you didn't look close enough.
Now, if you don't leave, I'll call the police.
Well, that's ironic.
He waves his hand in the air and walks away with his shoulders slumped. Clearly, this got to him.
I decide not to chase after him. He's at the point now where he doesn't care how much I harass his clients. He's more concerned with his own safety.
Chapter 56 Insider. I peer across the dark field from my hiding spot in the trees, waiting for Oyo to show up. Both the sun and the moon have already set, and the only illumination in my night vision goggles comes from the light of the stars. His children's camp is deserted, with the exception of the occasional possum that takes a stroll across the grounds, looking to see if the humans have returned and brought with them their offerings. I parked my car a quarter mile away and walked the distance here, clinging to the tree line so Oyo couldn't spot me from the road. I've only seen 4 cars pass in the last hour. None of them pulled into the retreat. I don't know if Robert's clue was intentionally misleading or if I misinterpreted it. Right now I'm at my wit's end, trying to figure out what to do next. I'm not sure what I expected to see. Oyo pulling up and opening the door to a secret cellar? Dragging a child into one of the camp buildings? I took a walk through the woods behind the camp. The trees are fairly spread apart, and the trails well marked. It's not some sinister forest from a dark fairy tale. It would be hard to hide anything in there. I can imagine a few moonshine stills and some squatter shacks years ago, when the area was less developed. Now it's the kind of place day hikers walk through on a regular basis. It also doesn't feel like the kind of place a predator would feel comfortable. Much as humans have an aesthetic sense of a safe space, small bodies of water surrounded by trees, long open vistas, predators have environments in which they feel comfortable. For serial killers, it's usually their home or their car. Gacy had his crawl spaces. Bundy had his mobility. What does Oyo have? His double lives, living side by side? The ability to be a man of God to the public and a servant of evil in private? There's something masterful about how he intertwined the two worlds. His past atrocities put him in a position of power that was useful to the intelligence agents looking at what they thought was a bigger problem. After my encounter with Cold War Bill, I suspect that Oyo isn't simply an informer. His ministry may be one of those mysterious enterprises that clandestine parts of our government use to funnel guns and money to parts of the world where we're fighting secret wars. That means the people calling the shots are literally on the front lines. They look at my interference as an act of treason, maybe not in law, but in spirit. While I find it hard to believe they really know what Oyo is up to, I suspect that nobody wants to dig all that deeply. It's collateral damage in a greater conflict, from their point of view. I check my watch. It's getting late. Not quite witching hour, but Oyo probably has given his victim his sleep juice by now. Wherever they are. I could be back at his house in an hour, but I am certain he's not there. I'm also kicking myself for not inspecting his church. While I seriously doubt he'd bring a victim back there, it could still have some clue to his whereabouts. I decide he's not showing up and crawl from my hiding spot.
This was a bust. Best case scenario, Oyo got worried and decided not to pull anything tonight, and I'm just working myself into a frenzy. I don't know that he's going to kill tonight. It just seemed right. But how things seem isn't the proper way to do science. I have to work on logic and facts. Fact: Oyo hasn't shown up at the retreat. I walk through the camp, peering into the windows with my night vision goggles. Empty buildings waiting for children to return and fill them with their voices. Right now the only sounds are crickets and frogs. I close my eyes and listen more closely. There's another sound, almost like dripping water. I move closer to the source, trying to understand what it is. There's something random about it. It's a kind of plonk noise. There's also something familiar. It's not a natural sound. It's an imitation of one. I cock my head to the side and place the sound somewhere in front of me. My eyes still closed, I walk toward the source. Something metal rattles as I bump into a barrier. When I open my eyes, I'm looking at a foliage-covered chain-link fence. The one standing between the camp and the old, overrun nursery. Carefully, trying not to rattle the fence any more than I already have, I pull myself up and peer over the edge. There's an overgrown wilderness of plants and small trees. At one end, there's a small house with an open glass door in the back. The inside is lit by the glow of a large television. A cartoon frog is jumping from one lily pad to another. A child's laugh pierces through the night air, and chills run through my body. Before I climb the fence into the wooded lot, I have a realization. I should have looked more closely at the other homes on Wimbledon.
Chapter 57. Lair. My feet touch the wet soil, and I'm in a different world. The dark leaves of the wild ferns and saplings are black cutouts against a dark gray sky. It's a mini jungle that reeks of a thousand scents. Rotting vegetation, blooming flowers left unattended, and, underneath it all, the sickly sweet smell of decaying flesh. I'm reminded of Amorphophallus titanum, the so-called corpse flower, which resembles a giant loaf of French bread emerging from an inverted bell. But that's not the source of these scents. The flora are too densely packed for me to gauge the size of the nursery, other than what I recall from the Google Earth view. The lot is at least as deep as the retreats, although it's nowhere near as wide. With the thickly spaced plants and trees, it might as well be the Amazon. I can barely spot the glow of the television in the house from my new vantage point, but my feet find small flagstones, which I presume meander their way to the front of the property. Even though my curiosity is calling me toward the back, I have to go check and make sure the child playing the game is still unharmed. I thread my way through branches and thick ferns, trying not to make scraping sounds or upset any of the dozen cracked statues and fountains that lie on either side of the path. As I draw closer, the plunk, plunk sound of the game grows louder. I hope this means the child is still conscious. The foliage begins to thin out, and I find myself on a concrete patio. The house is directly before me. To my right is a passageway lined with trellises. This may have been the customer entrance back when this was a functioning business. Through the open sliding glass doors, I see the back of a small brown head sitting on a couch facing the television. Occasionally, he bounds up or down as his frog reaches some level. I remain motionless, looking for my prey. The game pauses, and the boy's head moves forward. I take another step and see him reach for a glass of grape-colored liquid.
I'm about to run into the living room and slap it out of his hand when I hear the basso of a voice. I can't make out the words, but from somewhere else in the house, an adult is speaking. I have my gun. I could go in there now. What if it's not him? What if it is? Unless my plan is to shoot him in cold blood, I need more. I need something I can point to if I call the cops. I can't just tell them my gut says they should dig up the backyard. I'm a trespasser. Suddenly, I understand how those detectives felt as they watched Ted Bundy wash away the evidence in his car. Powerless within the law. I tell myself that this child's fate will be similar to Artise's. He's safe until Oyo brings him to the killing room. The killing room is somewhere behind me. Somewhere in this twisted garden. I retreat back into the overgrowth and follow the path the other way, deeper into the dark. My night vision goggles give me a narrow field of view, so claustrophobic that I'm tempted to simply feel my way by touch. I use the goggles to keep an eye on the small flagstones and watch for anything that could trip me. One clumsy move, and I could let him know I'm here. The path winds left and right, but never backtracks. I assume it was set by the gardeners who previously owned this property, and was meant to give visitors a leisurely view of all they had to offer, and not some demented labyrinth meant to deceive a person trying to escape. Oyo is a clever opportunist, not a landscaper, I tell myself. The trees and shrubs give way to another open space. It's a small clearing with a broken fountain in the middle. Tilted at an angle, the peak rises to a sharp point. Dead leaves and brush fill the basin, while vines wrap around the cement, strangling the spire. A shed stands on the other side, its wooden walls even darker than the sky. A window on the side is covered with newspapers, concealing what's inside. The only source of light is the reflection on the gleaming padlock mounted to the sliding door. It's unlocked. I walk around the fountain and listen for a moment. I can still hear the distant sounds of the game. Artise's account of the shed at Wimbledon is forefront in my mind, along with the forensic details the LAPD was able to pull from it after the fact. The stench of decay is even stronger here. Plus, there's some acidic smell I can't quite place. A cleanser? I can't see the point of that. Toyman's murder scenes can't be cleansed. I grab the door handle and pull as gently as possible. The wood makes a small squeak as it slides from the ill-fitted frame. I hesitate, waiting for an immediate reaction, but none comes. I pull the door open wider, and it begins to slide open on its own accord. The first thing I notice is a black tarp on the ground. As my gaze drifts upward, I see row after row of wooden shelves on the back wall. Filled with glass bottles and metal cans, the shed's interior doesn't seem that out of place for a nursery. This would be where you'd keep your seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides. I step forward for a better view. My grainy night vision begins to resolve details in the darkness. These aren't seeds. The bottles are filled with murky liquids. Most are impossible to interpret, but the ones with human ears and eyeballs are unmistakable. Other jars contain parts I don't even want to acknowledge. The urge to throw up is so sudden and visceral I can barely control it. I've smelled dozens of corpses and even participated in human dissections, but I feel a different response now. This is the body's reaction to evil. I take my phone from my pocket and take a photo. The flash goes off and I panic, afraid that the light will somehow be visible from the house. It's unlikely, but still sends a shudder down my spine. I slowly back out of the shed and push the door into place. I almost lock it, then remember this was how I found it. When I let go of the lock, I realize that the video game has stopped playing. I pull my gun free and step away from the door. The wind is blowing, stirring the leaves. I walk around the fountain and take a side path leading to another side of the nursery. One careful step at a time, I try to find my way back to the house. Occasionally, I catch the glow of the television through the branches, giving some indication of direction. Thorns claw at my clothes, and vines threaten to trip me. I stoop to remove one from my ankle. When I stand again, the television is no longer visible. Did he just turn it off? I squint, trying to make out any detail in the dark. I can see a faint glow 30 yards in front of me, but it appears that it's being blocked. The television flickers back into view as the eclipse passes. Someone else is out here in the undergrowth. Chapter 58. Maze. I move even more cautiously than before, trying to discern the difference between the breeze rattling leaves around me and the sound of another man moving through the brush. Attempting to keep as low a profile as possible, I put my gun at hip level and sweep it back and forth as I move to the next stone. There's a crack beneath my feet. I glance down and see the image of a child's jaw through my night vision goggles. A jointed skeleton of a finger sticks out of the earth nearby, hauntingly pointing to the sky. This confirms what my nose had already told me. This is a garden of death. God knows what else is out here. I already saw his trophy collection in the shed. My ears twitch as I hear something scrape against concrete. He's now moved to my rear, flanking me from behind. He has home field advantage. I'm just blindly moving through his snare. I weigh the risk of simply firing my gun, but discount the foolish notion immediately. The chances of hitting someone are almost zero, but that someone could be the child. The child, I remind myself. I can't fail. It's all about him. I keep moving toward the glow. I can hear the sound of movement getting closer to me. I could kneel down and lie in wait, ready to fire my gun. But my feet keep moving me forward. The television is getting larger, and I can make out a score on the screen. Footsteps. I definitely hear footsteps behind me. I run forward, leap through the brush, and emerge onto the patio. The child is no longer visible on the couch, but I see a foot in a white sock poking out over an armrest. The noise behind me is much louder, like a wild animal running through the brush. I race into the house, rip off the goggles, and slide the glass door shut. The first thing I see is the bright image of my own reflection. I press my face against the glass and see a shape standing out there. Tall, powerful, right at the edge of the patio. I lock the glass door and run around to the couch. The boy looks to be about 12. He's passed out with his head on a pillow. The cup of purple liquid is gone. Still gripping the gun and casting nervous glances at the back door, I peel open the child's eyelids. Yellow eyes look up at me. His pupils are dilated. I give him a slap on the cheek. "Wake up!" I whisper.
"Are we gonna go see the fort now?"
he asks dreamily. "Kid, you don't want to go there." I pull him into a seated position and take out my phone. I dial 911 and blurt the address to the operator, then set the phone down but leave the line open. I ignore the dispatcher's pleas for more information as my entire attention focuses on the glass door. He's out there. What are you going to do now, Oyo? I have the kid and found this place. Do you turn into a rage monster like Joe Vick? Or do you sneak away into the night? I get an answer a moment later when a statue comes shattering through the glass. Broken shards fly at me. I duck down and protect the kid. The stonework crashes into the glass coffee table and falls to the floor. I stick my gun over the edge of the sofa and fire into the darkness. Bang! 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 I squint through the opening and can see only the tops of the overgrown plants against the night sky. If this were Joe Vick, I'd be worried that he'd be coming in through the front door. But he's not. He's something else entirely. The toy man knows when to run. In the distance, I can hear the sound of sirens. I wait until they're right outside, then put my gun back into my holster. I won't be needing it again tonight. Chapter 59. Surrogates. I've been inside a holding cell for 4 hours, and nobody has even come to talk to me since the police brought me in. The cops on the scene did their job. They treated me with an appropriate amount of suspicion, got the kid to the hospital, then let me lead them through the bone-strewn garden and the little shack of horrors, which was even more horrifying the second time. Oyo must have freaked out and started ripping shelves from the walls. There were body parts and noxious fluids everywhere. One cop puked. I wisely kept my distance from the door. When we arrived at the police station, I wasn't in handcuffs, but a lieutenant was waiting outside for us. He said something to the cops who brought me in, and the next thing I knew, I was in bracelets and escorted to this holding room. Somebody spoke to someone. Now the question on my mind is who is going to be the next person to walk through that door. Will it be Bill with a pistol and a silencer? Will it be some rough ex-con randomly placed in my cell? Or am I just getting too damn paranoid? What I know is that Oyo the Toy Man is on the run, and probably off to his next kill spot. My gut tells me it won't be in the United States. I'm not sure how far I can chase him. I barely made it this distance. There's the sound of keys, and the door opens. A short woman in her mid-30s, dressed in a suit jacket and skirt, enters the room and sits across from me. She's got dark hair and aquiline features. Her eyes give away the fact that she's intelligent. After the door shuts, she drops a folder onto the table in front of me.
Dr. Cray, let's go over your story.
Am I making a statement?
No, she replies. I'm going to give you your story. What you need to tell them, how you found the house.
Pardon me? I thought I had that already. She taps her fingernails on the metal table and assesses me for a moment.
There are two kinds of facts, Dr. Cray. The ones that you can prove and the ones you cannot. What you think is irrelevant.
She opens the folder and studies it.
You received an anonymous tip from someone in Atlanta that brought you to Mr. Basque's home.
Basque? Who is he? She pulls a photo from the folder and shows it to me. Other than the fact that he's black, he looks nothing like Oyo.
This is Mr. Basque. He's the one that killed the people found at 437 Sweetwater Road.
No, he's not. What is he, some patsy you keep on standby?
His name is on the rental receipt. The child has already identified him as the one that picked him up.
The kid is still high on the concoction Oyo gave him. He'd say Santa Claus did it.
Why are you protecting this monster? We're not. If there is a third party, they will be dealt with.
I can't believe this.
I know you guys do stupid things, but I can't believe you'd protect a child murderer. What am I missing here?
It hits me all at once.
Yourselves. Fuck. I get it. You had no clue, or you were looking the other way. This is how you try to cover your asses when it turns out you aided and abetted a murderous pedophile.
I let out a deep breath, finally glimpsing the whole picture.
This is fucking big.
It's not just one agency supervisor that falls on their sword. This is the kind of thing that makes news for months and means congressional inquiries, funding cuts, and that kind of thing. Am I right? She has no reaction.
So, are we clear on the anonymous phone call?
I shake my head.
No, we are not. Lies are not how you fix fuck-ups.
Dr. Cray, I have a copy of a document you signed explaining that you fully understood the penalties for exposing intelligence secrets.
Yeah, and there's a part in there about the Constitution. And there are whistleblower laws. Lady, it doesn't work like this.
Then I'll have to take your actions as being hostile to the interests of the United States.
I try to raise my hands, but I'm stopped by the fact that they're locked to the table.
Whoa! You don't get to wave the Patriot flag. That's what the Chinese government says to people before they send them off to the organ-harvesting van. That's what bad guys with badges say.
My mysterious visitor checks her watch, taps her fingers on the table again, then replies,
"We're done."
She gets up, knocks on the door, and leaves. I shout through the open door, "Can I have a phone call?" It's slammed without a response. Half an hour later, two deputies come to get me. I try to ask them when I get to speak to someone, but they ignore me. We walk down a row of crowded holding cells and into another section, where one cell sits empty. They professionally push me to the back of the cell and uncuff one hand, only to have me put both hands behind me so they can cuff me to the back row of bars. I glance at a name tag.
Deputy Henley, doesn't this seem a little unusual?
Just following instructions, sir, he says, with genteel southern politeness.
Something fucked up is happening here. I'm not sure if the kindly deputy has any clue.
I'm supposed to get a phone call.
You had your call, sir. You can talk to the judge tomorrow.
But I was never even charged with anything.
He and the other deputy back away and shut the door. I can't get the fact out of my mind that the other cells were crowded, yet here I am in my own private suite. Something seriously fucked up is going on here.
Chapter 60. Vigilante. I don't close my eyes. I don't take my attention away from the door leading into this cell. If Cold War Bill was the ghost of Christmas past, and Mysterious Woman is the ghost of Christmas present, then the next visitor is going to be the ghost of Christmas yet to come, and something tells me I ain't going to like what he's bringing. Whichever division fucked this up has probably decided, using whatever ethically damaged decision-making process they have, that the life of one disgraced loudmouth professor isn't worth their jobs or their freedom. I was told to stay away, and I didn't. I was given the chance to play ball, and I refused. Now they're out of options, and time. From Birkett's histrionic phone call, I know she's not in on this. I'm not in 6 days of the Condor territory here, I hope. I'm just dealing with a couple of bad cops, who happen to work for an intelligence agency. If this were an authorized operation, I'd probably be in a black helicopter on my way to some secret rendition site. But that doesn't make them less threatening, only more so. When the door to the cell opens, my skin shivers, as adrenaline courses through me like water down the Amazon. The deputies are bringing in two more guests. And shit. The first one is a skinhead with neck tattoos and an honest-to-goodness swastika on his arm. He weighs in at about 160 and is already staring at me with hate in his eyes. Somebody told him something, because I'm usually a pretty likable guy at first glance. The other man is more muscular and doesn't have any tattoos. He's got a flat-top cut, not a full skinhead dome. Skinhead is uncuffed and takes a seat right across from me so he can stare me down. Flathead moves to the corner to my right, about 5 feet away from me. He crosses his arms and leans back, as if he doesn't have a care in the world. I wait to see how this show is supposed to start. Clearly Skinhead has it in for me, but why is Flathead here? Are they a team? As soon as the deputies leave, Skinhead gets up
and stands in front of me. I already stretched my legs out so I could use them to protect my space.